quick message from our sponsor, Bump Social. Bump Social is a new revolutionary social media app that is coming out on iOS and Android with new tools and features and functionality for users, brands, creators, influencers, the whole gamut, to really take the social experience to a whole new level. So make sure to check them out in our description down below. Again, they'll be out very soon on iOS and Android, so stay tuned. What's up, guys? Welcome back to another episode of the Blockhash Podcast, episode 390. Today, we have an amazing group here, Henry and Roshan, both co-founders at Decimal Digital Currency, a Bitcoin mining company, to talk about Bitcoin in the market and what they're seeing from their perspective and what's going on within the industry. It's going to be quite a deep conversation. Henry, Roshan, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you guys here. How's your week been going so far?
Thanks, Brandon. It's been an interesting week. It's been a good week. It's always interesting in the mining world.
Before we dive in and get started, maybe we can take turns. Each of you would love to let the audience get an idea of who both of you guys are, and maybe what some of you guys have done prior and leading up to Decimal Digital Currency. Whoever wants to go first.
Sure. So my background has primarily been in real estate. I've been in commercial real estate brokerage. I have my own real estate investment firm that's quite active. And I also own or co-own a health and wellness company primarily focused on aesthetics and with a growing vertical in wellness. The Bitcoin mining company is a large part of what I do, but it's one of three other businesses.
True entrepreneur.
Trying to be.
Henry, what about you?
Sure, yeah. So before Decimal, my entry into the crypto world was back in like 2016, 2017. I was at a number of startups, you know, app development, options trading, right? Real estate investment, just kind of a variety of things looking for good returns. And I came across Ethereum mining. And, before I knew it, I had a few hundred GPUs in my garage. That was my start in crypto.
I can kind of relate to that. One of my first entry points into crypto was crypto mining as well. And I was living in Oregon back in the time. This was like late 2017. When GPU mining for Ethereum was actually still a thing and it was actually still profitable. I remember having to go to Best Buy or drive down to Vegas to go to Fry's Electronics to buy up as many GPUs as I could. And they would limit me to like 5, 6, 7 GPUs at a time. And they get pissed every time I came in. And I'm like, who cares? Buying them.
Yeah, I used to buy them. I'd buy them under my sister's name, send some to her apartment in New York. Newegg. Newegg is where I would go.
Newegg was a good one.
Yeah.
Yep. Or Micro Center, load a car full of four of my friends. We drive to Micro Center, every one of them, give them cash. We buy the max GPUs, come back the next day. It was an interesting time.
Yeah, you kind of had to do what you could. It felt like a little bit of a gold rush, but in like, you know, data crunching for Bitcoin or for Ethereum or for just the crypto market, but it was very fascinating. And I ran into so many issues trying to do it that it wasn't worth doing. And I just kind of figured after playing around with it for 2 years, it really needs to be done at scale for it to be successful. Because if you're doing it as a small miner, you're just going to be eaten alive by HVAC costs and electricity and rents and fluctuations in the market. So it ended up not being for me. But clearly it was for you guys, and you guys formed Decimal Digital Currency. So how did that kind of, you know, come to fruition? Like, how did you get start this and then, you know, grow it to what it is today?
Yeah, I mean, amazingly, it's exactly as you just said, which is that Henry had this operation, this Ethereum mining operation. We met just by pure happenstance, and I knew nothing about Ethereum, knew nothing about cryptocurrencies. And when Henry and I got talking and I went to his home and I saw what he had built, and then I came to learn of the economics around it, I said, we need to scale this and we need to do it in a much more professional manner. So primarily with self-funding, we grew the business with Henry at the helm. And then with the switch from proof of work to proof of stake, we knew we needed to pivot out of it. Unfortunately, we sold all the Ethereum during the crypto winter of 2017, 2018.
Ah, man.
Which of course was a mistake. I've never sold anything since and never will. But that's when we knew that this is real. And the pivot was to go all in on Bitcoin mining, which is something that we launched in 2020. Well, we laid the groundwork in 2020 and then launched officially in 2021. We started with the friends and family round, raised a bunch of capital, bought machines, unfortunately near the peak of the market, but nonetheless, we were able to make a pretty good dent in getting started, and then set up hosting sites around the country, several of which we still have.
How many miners do you guys have running, or at least how many operations at this point? Size of scale.
Yeah, we have six different sites around the country. We're gonna close one and open another two, and we're at tens of thousands of machines at this point, and rapidly growing. Yeah.
Did you have to pick locations based on geography or based on electricity costs in certain environment? Like, what was some of the factors going into that?
Yeah, the power cost, of course, is critical. And making sure that it's a sustained low power cost that's fixed. We've run into issues in the past where we thought it was fixed. We've been told it was fixed, only to later learn that it's not. A cooler climate, of course, is preferred, with the exception of maybe Texas, although not the biggest fan of mining in Texas. And honestly, the biggest struggle that we've come across is counterparty risk with these third party hosting providers. And despite the fact that everything may check out, you may have an incredibly low power cost, you may have a cooler climate, the infrastructure may be in place. There's a lot that goes into the overall structure with the financial wherewithal of this company. How many machines they're also hosting, what the efficiency is of those machines, what their debt profile is on their overall setup, what their rent is, who their landlord is, what the terms of their lease for the site are. Like, there's a lot that goes into it, and it's almost impossible to fully de-risk it, which is part of why we think that with the next post-halving, the next phase of our business is really going to be establishing our own sites. So we want to move into site development. We want to vertically integrate and then kind of bring everything all in-house and start buying our own sites, developing our own sites. And we think that we have been developing our own site right now. We think we're pretty good at it, and we want to start doing it at scale.
Very cool. What are some of the maybe hurdles or challenges you guys ran into while going through this process? I know there's probably quite a few, because there was for me when I was trying to do it even as a smaller miner. So I imagine trying to do it at a large scale, things crop up every once in a while and you're like, oh, I didn't think I had to account for this or account for that.
For me, it's all the only thing, and I don't mean this to come across as arrogant or cocky, but I feel as though from a pure mining perspective, I think that we get it better than most. I think that Henry is an absolute savant. He understands every nuance of the mining business. I think that from a capital raising standpoint, it's not difficult for us. We can go out and raise as much money as we want anytime we want. We can procure. I think we have fantastic supplier relationships globally to procure infrastructure, transformers and PDUs, whatever we need, as well as machines, right? Getting the hardware, that's not a problem for us, and we can get it at extremely preferential pricing. The problem has really been with the host providers. I mean, there's a lot of head fakes and smoke and mirrors, and I think it's pervasive in the industry, but particularly with the host providers, they're a problem. And I'm hoping, unfortunately, I think that they're going to be even more of a problem. I think you're going to see a lot of them go under post-halving. But that, again, it's why you look at the largest publicly traded mining operations. It's why Marathon is no longer being hosted, right? They want to be the one hosting, and they're going out, they're buying sites left and right. That's kind of the way in which, if you want to make it in this business, you can't rely on a third party provider. So Henry, you may have a different perspective on what our challenges have been, but for me, that's the one that gives me the most
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And, you know, something you said in there that after the halving, you expected to get worse. I think that that's, you know, kind of especially insightful, you know, something we should pay attention to, because when the halving hits right now, there's maybe 4 million rigs that are an S19 Pro or worse, right? And any base model S19, any M30S Plus or worse, anything, right? All of the prior generations, of course, they'll be producing Bitcoin pretty close to break even or worse. If we see another drawback, you know, or pullback down to the 50s, let's say 58,000, then we might see 25% of the network fail, at least temporarily. So if you're a hosting provider that has, as Roshan said, right, you've got rent costs, you've got staff costs, you might have debt costs, any other SG&A, if that overcomes your suddenly 25% reduced margin, you're underwater. And then even though, you know, let's say us running S21s, we're producing Bitcoin at $20,000 or less today, you know, we're very comfortable with the halving coming up because our cost of production is so low. But if our host goes under because their other clients failed, it doesn't help. You know, we're still at their mercy. And the counterparty risk is very tough. I think in terms of building sites, you know, that's where we were when you asked this question. The biggest challenge is that you have 6 or 7 parallel paths that all have to land at the same time. And sometimes there's interdependency between them, right? You've got to get to step 3 on one before you can do step 1 on the other. And meshing that all out, you know, if you do it correctly, you can put a site up in a couple months, right? 60 days, 90 days. And if things don't match up, it can take 6, 8, 9 months. And you lose a lot of revenue if the logistics aren't right. So I'd say, you know, having strong supply chains, you know, confidence in your delivery timings of things, a good project manager, you know, those are key for putting a site together.
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, for myself, as I mentioned, I come from a real estate background, and part of what I was doing is on some of my real estate projects is just project management, construction development. And so lining up all of these pieces and sequencing them all one after the other in the most efficient manner is something that I think I can do pretty well. But when you're doing this in the middle of nowhere, Oklahoma, and you're reliant on getting subs that know what they're doing and show up on time and getting it done in a cost-effective manner, it is very challenging. Yeah, as Henry said, that loss of revenue each and every day, it weighs on you.
And then why did you guys switch to focus primarily on Bitcoin? Was that more based on the fact that it's an easier model to follow and to mine, or was there other reasons why?
It was long before, you know, Ethereum mining was still very profitable when we made this choice, maybe close to the, you know, the peak of its profitability, or, you know, when Ethereum was $4,000, something like that in the last bull run. And the reason we did it is we saw that the Ethereum Foundation was prioritizing, right? They had a project roadmap with, let's say, 10 things on it. And they started removing items from that roadmap and putting them to after the merge, right? They said, okay, we're going to delay this priority. We're going to delay that priority. They kept signaling over and over again that the merge had to happen as soon as possible. The difficulty bomb increases and ICE, right? The augmentations to the Ethereum mining economics that kept reducing it, reducing the Ethereum reward to miners from 5 to 3, right? There were signs all along that there was an end date to it, and we wanted to leave before millions of GPUs hit eBay. So, you know, we exited GPUs when they were still valuable. We didn't buy any when they were squeezed, and then, you know, we watched their price go down 70%. So it was just a market timing decision. It was a risk off.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was stuck with a lot of GPUs, and I had to tediously flip them and sell them back to gamers. Luckily, I was able to sell most of them back because gamers really wanted the good ones that I all had. I felt like I could open up my own Best Buy. I had so many for a little while. I totally understand that. And then do you guys like source through like Bitmain, or are there better ASIC miners out there now for Bitcoin? I'm kind of curious. I have not really paid attention the last few years.
Yeah, we have sourced with Bitmain. I'll be careful what I say, but that creates its own challenges. We prefer several other channels, secondary channels to go through. Better protection, nearly identical pricing. I think that based on their connections in Asia, we're able to get machines more quickly. They've got a logistics set up for us that enables us to get these machines as probably even quicker than if we were buying from Bitmain. And you know, the Bitmain procurement locks you into a contract, a fixed contract, and usually you're getting these machines over a fixed schedule every month for, call it, 6 months. We'd rather buy it all at spot, get it up front. There are other players. I mean, and they're emerging. You look at a group like Auradine come out. I mean, their current machine that they have is not quite as attractive from a financial or efficiency standpoint as the S21, but their new machine, which will be released and available for purchase in July, I think, Henry, you would know, should be better than even the S21 Pro. I think it's even better than an S21 Pro. And these are really sharp guys. I mean, very sophisticated. We've spent time with their management team. They've thought of it all. And I think that continues, you know, it will still be tough to compete with Bitmain. Even MicroBT, I think, has a relatively difficult time competing with Bitmain. But there are new entrants into the market that are popping up. And I think that there will be more. Eventually, it'll become a little bit less concentrated.
Those were always like huge, like energy sucks for me to get like ASICs. But they, for some reason, like I thought they were never going to be able to add more computing power and lower or consolidate the energy that each of those ASIC machines uses. And then every year, every couple of years, they come out with another one. They seem to actually do that and replace the last one before it. Do you guys have to like turn over machines often, or do you just find ways to keep scaling it?
No, we do. I mean, they're now down to the 3-nanometer chipset, right? So with it, where they are now with 3, it's going to be pretty hard for them to get exponentially more efficient. Therefore, the machines that we have now, we think will be the useful life of them, not physically, but from monetarily, we think will last years. That being said, we have found ways in which to identify arbitrage where we're selling machines wholesale. We're selling machines retail. Albeit smaller increments, and then going out, recycling that capital and buying newer, more efficient machines on a wholesale basis. So nearly a wash. And that's something that we plan to do more of. We only have, I don't know, Henry, you would know better, but a few hundred, maybe 1,000 machines that are not of this newest generation. And I think that we'll keep them. We'll keep them, but the majority of our fleet are XPs or better.
So let's zoom out on this a little bit. I want to talk about the Bitcoin halving coming up here in the next 10 days or so. I believe it's scheduled for April 20th, and it feels like it's
a holiday for Henry.
Thanks.
I feel like it's going to be a much different halving cycle than in the past, given a lot of things happening in the macro environment. What are some things that you guys are expecting to see or maybe think could happen here heading into this halving cycle in the next week or so?
The halving is a reduction in the subsidy, and that subsidy is the amount of new Bitcoin created per block that us miners get. Right now, there are 900 new Bitcoin issued each day, roughly. So we'll go down to 450 on a monthly basis. That brings us from 27,000 roughly down to 13,500. In dollar terms, that's about $1 billion per month. So if we look at the net inflows on the ETFs and you know how that's affected price, we'd be adding an extra $30 million a day, right? So the impact of that is not tremendous, but it's significant. And if we stay in a kind of steady state of supply and demand in the market, right now we're at $70,000. If buyers and sellers stay exactly where they are, and there's $1 billion fewer to be sold, right, you know, the kind of logic there tells you that the price should appreciate. Historically, we've seen gigantic appreciations in price following a halving. But, you know, a kind of counterpoint to that is that the first halving cut the block reward from 50 to 25, right? That was 25 Bitcoin every 10 minutes that suddenly stopped. now we're only losing 3.25, right? We're going from 3.125. We're going from 6.25 down to 3.5. In Bitcoin denominated terms, this is not really that big a deal. And those are the two kind of forces in either direction that that push and pull.
Yeah, that's interesting, Henry. I haven't thought about it that way. That actually, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But I still do feel like people are vastly underestimating the supply squeeze. That with this amount of inflow, and then if you strip out the grayscale outflows, and we haven't even thought about the fact or considered the fact that I think Morgan Stanley and Goldman and their ETFs haven't launched yet. I think that people are not really thinking about the fact that there's going to be a way smaller supply than the amount of inflows coming in. And I think my belief is that the Bitcoin price, I mean, sure, yeah, we're already near, we're at all-time highs at 72 or 73, wherever we are today. I easily see that going to above 100,000 in the near term.
Similarly bullish there. You know, I think another thing to add, you know, you mentioned earlier that retail hasn't jumped in, right? That is an important part of this. And what we need to see is here, you know, now that the historical all-time high, this 70,000 area, what we couldn't break last bull market, now it's turned into a kind of support, right? We're sitting here and we're not going below it. And if the larger holders of Bitcoin are distributing their coins to smaller retail holders, that kind of over time, right, that cements this area as a new floor, right, or a new base to discover new price from and upwards. So, you know, what we're seeing right now is kind of a technical play out, a turnover of inventory, setting us up for a continuation.
I saw this stat the other day. I'll try and send it over to you guys if I can find it again, but it was looking at the supply rate that produced by miners currently for Bitcoin before the halving, and looking at the accumulation rate for asset managers for just the Bitcoin ETFs. And asset managers, especially leading ones like BlackRock, they've accumulated twice as much as what miners can actually produce. And it has led to a lot of speculation that, you know, come the halving cycle, there could be a massive supply crunch to the point where it could, you know, potentially have devastating effects on the economics of Bitcoin too. Yeah, it could be good for the value of it, but if all this Bitcoin is locked up and you can't produce it at the same time and keep up with the pace of demand, you know, is there going to be any issues with, you know, transaction times? Is there going to be issues with being able to keep miners in the market? Are there going to be issues with sustaining the ecosystem that's been built over multiple years now for Bitcoin? Mm-hmm. You know, curious, maybe any thoughts you guys have to that, and if you think a true supply crunch may be coming, and maybe what some of those effects could be, positive or negative.
Okay, well, you know, first to hit the premise of miners produce X and asset managers buy Y, you know, there is other supply out there, right? There's 19 million coins. You know, it's not just miners selling the new coins we mine that can give supply. There are people who have sell orders at 80,000. There are people who have sell orders at 90. There are people who have sell orders at 100, right? There's an order book going all the way up. And that order book would have to be eaten through by this supply squeeze, right? So I don't think that it's a snap of the fingers event. I think it'll be if we look at Tesla, for example, as a stock, right, if their huge run could be considered a short squeeze, right? They had a huge amount of shorts bet against them, and it took a long time for that to unwind. And those bets were forced to buy back at higher prices, and it made this gamma ramp and continuation and so on, right? We could see that in Bitcoin, but the supply squeeze, all right, it doesn't have to live in human timeframes. It could take 4 months, it could take 6 months, it could take 12, right, for us to get to the point where at each time we break through a new, let's say, wall, there's a period of consolidation like we're in now to turn over the inventory that wall unlocked. And then once that inventory is depleted, we see a parabolic move up again until there's something in the way. So I think those market forces could create stability, right? Not like $1 million coin tomorrow, right? In terms of usability of the network, keeping miners attracted to it, Bitcoin is dynamic in that every 2 weeks the difficulty will adjust, and by difficulty I mean the metric that tells us how hard it is to solve a block, for a miner to solve a block. The idea behind that is to keep the block time consistent at 10 minutes. So if Bitcoin, let's say, went to, you know, $1 million a coin, every single machine in the world, all of the old miners would all plug back in because they would suddenly be profitable again. And the Bitcoin network would have huge hash rate. You know, we'd probably go up 50% very quickly, 60%, whatever it is. And then as fast as they can produce new machines, they would get pumped out. Maybe even, you know, chip 6 or 7 nanometer productions might start getting made again just because they're profitable if Bitcoin were that high. So then the network in a, let's say that happens, right? And we get this huge, gigantic network, and then the price really crashes, 90% pullback, like we've seen many times. That could cause volatility in the network function. Because if hash rate gets all the way up to, let's say, you know, 2 exahashes at $1 million a coin post-halving, Bitcoin comes all the way back down to 100K. Now we might have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 weeks until the difficulty can reset again because none of those miners would be profitable. Right? Like, that's an example. But again, once it resets, we're fixed. It goes back to some kind of normalcy. So I think that the long-term resilience of the network, we don't really care. We just, there might be some volatility.
And what do you think is driving the current value for Bitcoin right now? Because it feels like retail isn't fully into the market yet, for many reasons. Like, I don't see the diamond hands and laser eyes like we did in 2021. Maybe the cycle will be different, but you tend to see a little bit of that during every tip of the bull cycle. And then obviously the US is kind of teetering on potential recession and interest rates are incredibly high. US dollars are very expensive because of interest rates. So it's harder for ordinary Americans to speculate and throw money into a new investment. Do you feel like this has mostly been driven by institutional interest and adoption? Or is there a retail side of this, you know, maybe that we're just still waiting on to play in and we just kind of getting started in this market?
Okay. Yeah. You know, the last craze, we also had the pandemic, right? A lot of people were had more free time, right? Had more liquidity due to pandemic programs. And also the Robinhood trading era, the GameStop era was kind of close to the same time. That created a lot of liquidity for crypto adjacent investors or for people to throw into crypto. But this time, you're right. You know, there's almost none of that. And on chains, you know, data shows that retail's not really participating the way institutions are. One caveat is that we don't necessarily know how many retail investors are just buying the ETF. It could be that a good amount of this ETF volume is individuals saying, oh, I'm going to put, you know, a few hundred bucks of Bitcoin in my portfolio. And, you know, you asked why. I think that there's a game theory playing out. Why is Bitcoin's price appreciating like this? Is that if you're a huge fund and you have to post a 12% rate of return or else you get fired, right? And you know that you can get 10% out of, you know, your regular stuff, and you say, okay, well, if Bitcoin goes crazy, I can guarantee that I won't get fired, right? I guarantee that I hit my number, I get my promote, whatever it is. And if I put like a 2% allocation there, I make my number. But if I put a 2% allocation there and it fails, I can still do it in other ways. So all of these asset managers across wealth management are choosing Bitcoin as like a hedge to Bitcoin, right? It's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy because an allocation to it gives you protection against its explosion in value against other assets, but that allocation to it's what's creating its explosion in value. And that game theory is not just playing out among ETF investors and individual portfolios. It's countries, right? This is wealth of nations. We have Bhutan, for example, right? They put $500 million more into their mining operation. I expect in 10 years, that'll be one of the wealthiest countries in the world.
Yep. And El Salvador is going to be building a mining operation and on the backside of a volcano.
Yeah.
So obviously there's vested interest in it makes sense.
Yep.
What do you guys think about the Bitcoin ETFs? Obviously, that's been a driving narrative since maybe October of last year and has really kind of given life to the markets again, helping us come out of this bear market. Maybe that's where a lot of demand has gone. It seems like that's where a lot of it has gone, at least in terms of the inflows into the ETFs, as well as you know, maybe where that'll continue to go as they open up ETFs potentially to other cryptocurrencies and all this stuff. Like, who knows how wide and crazy this institutional era of Bitcoin and crypto is going to get. Mm-hmm. Do you guys think that this is a very positive thing overall, or do you think that this could have, you know, potentially negative effects, at least maybe on the retail side of things for Bitcoin and crypto and the way that we've seen and like the market? Just curious what you guys think about these ETFs overall and in general.
You know, I think us crypto people, right, we're already familiar with this concept. These ETFs are just wrapped Bitcoin, right? It's WBTC, except the DeFi you can do with it is you have it in your brokerage account. You have it in your stock account, in your 401k, right? If you want to take the tax benefit on Bitcoin, you can do it in the retirement or the tax preferred account. If you want to use it for leverage, you can put it in your collateralized, your margin account, use it as collateral for other trading. This is introducing the world to using Bitcoin as a financial asset integrated with other things, right? From that perspective, I think we're very, very excited. What that means for Bitcoin is a huge amount of liquidity. The SEC just delayed options on Bitcoin ETFs. But if you can imagine, what that kind of market could bring to Bitcoin, if all those ETFs had market makers putting option books on them, the capital could really accelerate the velocity of capital into Bitcoin. What was the other?
How about their fees?
Yeah, I mean, the fees are, you know, wrapped Bitcoin, you don't pay as high fees as you do with an ETF. Sitting a Bitcoin in ETF and bleeding it, it's like, I heard someone, I forget who it was, and I hate that I can't credit them because it was such a smart way to put it. I saw someone say that Bitcoin or the ETFs are like a Bitcoin black hole, and the Hawking's radiation is what you're losing, right? It's ejecting matter. And if you let your Bitcoin sit in there for 30 years, you have way less than self-custody than if you had self-custody because of that compounding interest against you.
I think it's fascinating. I think that it drives the right kind of interest into the market. I don't know if I'm privy to all these institutions owning Bitcoin and having it on their balance sheet, but I don't think it really matters because price will justify it over time and it'll just keep going up anyways. But I do think it's really good for the market. It forces regulation in a healthy way. It forces market adoption. It forces a bit more of a mainstream approach and acceptance. And I think that's something that we all strive for in this space, especially for Bitcoin and for the broader market. So yeah, I kind of like it, at least early on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Brandon, for me, I think that, you know, of course, I agree with everything you said, but and perhaps it goes hand in hand with adoption, but it's the validation. It's the validation that it brings when you have a mm-hmm. company of BlackRock or Fidelity stature taking this large of a position. I think it gives people confidence and comfort finally entering into the industry.
100%. And it doesn't seem like they're done either. Larry Fink keeps talking about tokenization. He seems fixated on the idea of putting every asset on earth on a blockchain. So I think it's only going to keep growing from here. What's next for you guys at Decimal? You guys talked a little bit about expanding out operations, doing all of these stuff yourself and in-house. What are some other things you guys are looking to do here in 2024, moving into 2025 with Decimal, and how you guys want to continue growing?
Yeah, I think that there's two things, one of which is earlier stage, and Henry should speak to it, which is some of our blockchain development projects that we'd love to see get underway with Henry and one other individual that we're talking to joining the team to spearhead. The other is we launched something last year called our SMA offering, a separate managed account. And essentially, we enable investors, high net worth individuals, family offices, whoever it may be, to participate in mining. And so, you know, when a lot of people ask me, like, hey, how do I get into Bitcoin, or should I buy Bitcoin today? Like, I have no idea, right? Like, I'm bullish. I think that long term, Bitcoin's only going one way. But in the near term, and depending on what your investment horizon is, I wouldn't be surprised at all if Bitcoin it crashes down to 30 or 40 or 50, whatever it is. But if you can get into mining, you know, if you're investing with Decimal today, even with Bitcoin at 72,000, Bitcoin could drop to $30,000 tomorrow and will still be incredibly profitable and cash flow for you as an investor. And so we go out, we procure machines on these investors' behalf. We then deploy those machines at one of our mining sites, and we're going to be expanding that portfolio. We get them racked, energized, optimized, and then handle every aspect of the mining business for them. So that includes the risk management, the security, the custody, the liquidations, the hedging, you name it. We're doing all of it. At the end of the month, we take that Bitcoin, whatever Bitcoin that we've produced over that month. We sell it, we pay the power bill, and then we have a profit sharing arrangement with that investor. So on a net basis, it's extremely attractive for them. The returns have been extremely attractive. They also get the full depreciation, so they have those tax benefits. And frankly, a lot of people they still don't fully understand Bitcoin. They are coming in based on these, based on the depreciation alone, because it's powerful. For the first time in my life, I didn't pay taxes last year, which was one of the greatest feelings I've ever had. And purely based on what we're doing here, at Decimal, like my accountant, who's brilliant, he couldn't believe it. So that's something that we think we want to grow, right? We've proven it out over the past year. It works. We've now got this down, to a science, and, we're growing that rapidly.
Where would you guys like to direct people from the audience that are listening to the show? Do you want them to check out any resources you have? Do you guys have a website or social media?
Oh God, we have a website that's living in the Stone Ages, but it's in the process of being updated over the next couple of months. We're actively working on it. I think the best way to reach us is info@decimalgroup.io. On social media, we have a LinkedIn page that we're trying to be diligent about keeping updated and active. But we love meeting with other people in the industry and talking to folks and building our industry network. So it'd be great to hear from people.
Awesome. And you guys are both on LinkedIn too, I presume, right?
Yes. Yes, mm-hmm. Very much so.
Awesome. Perfect. Henry, Rashawn, thank you guys for taking the time to come on the show and talk about Decimal, talk about your insights into the industry, into Bitcoin and the market, and some of the things that might be affecting it coming up with the halving cycle. It's going to be, in my opinion, a very exciting month, and I'm excited to see how these kind of things shape out for Bitcoin heading into the next quarter of this year. So guys, thanks for taking the time. Really do appreciate it.
Thanks, Brandon. Really appreciate you having us on. Very insightful commentary and questions. And we'll definitely be in Medellin at some point soon. So we'll be sure to get in touch with you.